Let's raise bodhicitta. Touching in with the heartfelt intention. To use our time together this afternoon to be of the highest benefit to beings. To recognize directly the inseparability of self and others. And to open fully to life. To all experience. Good, thank you. So I thought I'd continue with some of the next few verses from Shantideva. We're still in the first chapter, The Excellence of Bodhicitta. And this chapter, these verses, they're kind of twofold. One, we're learning about the qualities of bodhicitta so that we can ascertain for ourselves whether this is something that we're into or that seems like a worthy path or that resonates with us, right? We're doing our homework, so to speak, you know? The other aspect is that because of the instability of compounded objects, and that includes our emotions, our bodies, obviously, our minds. Things go up and down. We lose our motivation. We lose the spark that we have sometimes. This is normal. And so the other aspect of this chapter in literature like this is to inspire us. To like, it's like putting on a great song when you're going to go do a workout. You're like, yeah, all right. It's like that. And so part of what we're doing as Dharma practitioners is we're finding the teachers and the traditions and the methods and the techniques, and they don't need to be just within capital B Buddhism, that inspire us, that can help us get back on track or help us lift us up or help sober us when we're flown off into delusion, right? And there'll be times when something really resonates with you, but maybe next month, next year, 10 years later, it doesn't, and vice versa. So it's really good to be super open about it. Even if something doesn't resonate with you now, it might be the thing that like is the perfect key for you 5 years time, 1 week time. We just never know, right? And to me, that's one thing that's so exciting about the way that Buddha Dharma is taking root in the West, is we're all tasting various traditions and teachers and lineages. And it's gonna, to me, it's very tantric in that we're gonna be able to weave a beautiful quilt that's just for us. Because things do fit together. And there'll be various times when, I mean, this happens to me, it's happened to my teachers, where you might put down your tantric practice and you do like a straight shamatha or Zen practice or something. You have to be responsive to what's actually happening in your mind and your heart, right? Which takes tremendous bravery, because it means you have to touch it, right? It's vulnerable. It's much easier to be like, I do this, you know, and this says that. But it'll only get you so far. Yeah, and I do think that's also part of the beauty of the way Tantra's been preserved in the Indo-Tibetan lineages, is that it does encompass the fuller path. So there's no... there's no problem with taking different techniques when they're appropriate for us, right? You're not breaking any rules. Okay. I'm going to read two, I'm going to start with two verses that I read last night, and then we'll continue on. For when, with irreversible intent, the mind embraces bodhicitta, willing to set free the endless multitudes of beings, in that instant, from that moment on, a great and unremitting stream, a strength of wholesome merit, even during sleep and inattention, rises equal to the vastness of the sky. If with kindly generosity, one merely has the wish to soothe the aching heads of other beings, such merit knows no bounds. I'm going to read that again. If with kindly generosity, one merely has the wish to soothe the aching heads of other beings, such merit knows no bounds. No need to speak, then, of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every living being, bringing them unbounded excellence. Could our father or our mother ever have so generous a wish? Do the very gods, the rishis, even Brahma, harbor such benevolence as this? For in the past they never, even in their dreams, wished something like this even for themselves. How could they do it for another's sake? This aim to bring the benefit of beings, a benefit that others wish not even for themselves, this noble, jewel-like state of mind arises truly wondrous, never seen before. This pain-dispelling draft, this cause of joy for those who wander through the world, this precious attitude, this jewel of mind, how shall we calculate its merit? If the simple thought to be of help to others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddhas, what need is there to speak of actual deeds that bring about the weal and benefit of beings? If the simple thought to be of help to others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddhas, what need is there to speak of actual deeds that bring about the weal and benefit of beings? For beings long to free themselves from misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it as they would their foe. But those who fill with bliss all beings destitute of joy, who cut all pain and suffering away from those weighed down with misery, who drive away the darkness of their ignorance, what virtue could be matched with theirs? What friend could be compared to them? What merit is there similar to this? If someone who returns a favor is deserving of some praise, why need we speak of bodhisattvas who do good even unsolicited? People praise as virtuous, donors, those who with contempt support a few with plain and ordinary food, a moment's gift that feeds for only half a day. What need is there to speak of those who long bestow on countless multitudes the peerless joy of blissful Buddhahood the ultimate fulfillment of their hopes. Joyous and devoted thoughts will yield abundant fruits and greater strength. Even in great trouble, bodhisattvas never bring forth wrong. Their virtues naturally increase. To them in whom this precious jewel of mind is born, to them I bow. I go for refuge to those springs of happiness who bring their very enemies to perfect bliss. So just close your eyes and bring to mind whichever of those verses kind of stuck out to you. So now I'd like to do the 9-part purification breath again. Then we'll meditate for a little bit. And I'll go through the breath again. But I'd like to give the meditation invitation, advice, instruction, whatever, up front. So there's a stream of meditation within Indo-Tibetan Buddhism that's called analytical meditation. And it's where you actually, well, there like a lot falls under analytical meditation, actually. Anything where you're engaging the mind, and that includes practices that you do to test and develop your own compassion, even those are actually called analytical meditation. But the analytical meditation I'm talking about today is where you think about something. The topic here is bodhicitta. And if you're looking for, you can approach it through any way, right? But if you're looking for an in, it would be one of the verses that stood out to you. And it could be one that you're like, I don't know about that. Or one that you're like, oh, that was really lovely. Something like that. That's one option. Another option is to work on the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. And again, it's not just the words and the sounds. It's the yoking your intention to develop compassion, to embody compassion, to bring the greatest benefit and happiness to all beings. Joining it with that mantra so that the mantra feeds the intention and the intention feeds the blessings and the energy in the mantra. Yeah? Two options. And then the third option is to either be with the breath or for those of you that know or work with more spacious forms of cultivating awareness, you could do that. The three things clear? Okay. You can switch. We're not going to meditate very long, so I don't know how much, like I don't think you'll need to switch, but you can switch. But you just keep an eye on the mind often what will happen is when we feel, it's usually before you become aware that you're getting close to an edge, to something that's uncomfortable, you decide to switch, right? Because unconsciously you're like, yeah, maybe not yet. So if you have the, you'll notice before you even have the thought to switch, there's a feeling to switch. When you start to, if you can catch it, right? If you can start to catch the feeling or the thought, you just pause for a moment and see if the wise course is to kind of go with the flow and switch, because that's your wisdom saying, ooh, go here. Or if it's sort of like a neurotic avoidance that wants you to pull away. And who knows, right? It could be either one. That's the whole trick of it. So it's just an invitation to play like that. Okay. That's clear. Yeah. Okay. And so my last first question. Do you want me to read those verses again, or do you? You do. Okay. So we'll read the verses, then I'll explain the breath. We'll do the breath together again. And then you'll go into the meditation. The reason I wanted to give the meditation instruction before the breath, this doesn't often happen, like almost never happens to me when I'm by myself. This is the power of community. When we did it this morning, I could barely talk afterwards because my energy was aligned. My mind was clear, it was open, there was no words or thoughts in it. And I was like, not sure how I'm gonna teach. So that's why I gave you the instruction first. And it's funny because whenever we do this breath with my teacher, she's always like, how was it? And then she's like, I don't need to ask how it was. I can feel how it was. And I've always been like, I don't think it's the same for me as it is for you. But I got a real taste of it this morning. There's a part of me that always pulls back with it because subconsciously I can feel how powerful it is. That's the other part of the path, is what you notice, you're just constantly jumping off because you're like, I don't know if I'm ready for this. Right, I think I'm gonna read, let me see. Nah. I'm going to start with where I started today. Okay. For when, with irreversible intent, the mind embraces bodhicitta, willing to set free the endless multitudes of beings, in that instant, from that moment on, a great and unremitting stream, a strength of wholesome merit, even during sleep and inattention, rises equal to the vastness of the sky. If with kindly generosity, one merely has the wish to soothe the aching heads of other beings, such merit knows no bounds. No need to speak, then, of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every living being, bringing them unbounded excellence. No need to speak, then, of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every living being, bringing them unbounded excellence. Could our father or our mother even have so generous a wish? Do the very gods, the rishis, even Brahma, harbor such benevolence as this? For in the past they never, even in their dreams, wished for something like this, even for themselves. How could they do so for another's sake? This aim to bring the benefit of beings, a benefit that others wish not even for themselves, this noble, jewel-like state of mind, arises truly wondrous, never seen before. This pain-dispelling draft, this cause of joy for those who wander through the world, this precious attitude, this jewel of mind, how shall we calculate its merit? If the simple thought to be of help to others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddhas, what need is there to speak of actual deeds that bring about the weal and benefit of beings? For beings long to free themselves from misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it as they would their foe. But those who fill with bliss all beings destitute of joy, who cut all pain and suffering away from those weighed down with misery, who drive away the darkness of their ignorance, what virtue could be matched with theirs? What friend could be compared to them? What merit is there similar to this? If someone who returns a favor is deserving of some praise, why need we speak of bodhisattvas who do good even unsolicited? People praise as virtuous donors those who with contempt support a few with plain and ordinary food, a moment's gift that feeds for only half a day. What need is there to speak of those who long bestow on countless multitudes the peerless joy of blissful Buddhahood, the ultimate fulfillment of their hopes? All those who harbor evil in their mind, basically what the verse says is that because for someone who has given rise to the wish to bring all beings to Buddhahood, that if you harbor bad thoughts about them, you hurt yourself immeasurably because they're such a beautiful being, even if you can't see it. So it's saying, in contrast to bad thoughts about bodhisattvas, joyous and devoted thoughts will yield abundant fruits and greater strength. Even in great trouble, bodhisattvas never bring forth wrong. Their virtues naturally increase. To them in whom this precious jewel of mind is born, to them I bow. I go for refuge to those springs of happiness who bring their very enemies to perfect bliss. Okay, if you identify as a woman, on the right, when you blow out the right nostril, you're blowing out craving, grasping, in the color of red light. When you breathe out the left, you're breathing out anger, hatred, pushing away in the color of white light. If you identify as a man, when you breathe out the right, it's white anger. In the left, it's red craving or grasping. And then on the seventh inhalation, when we do the three-part exhalation, it's blue light. And that is you're breathing out ignorance, misperception. You're breathing out the fact that you experience the world as flat, even though it's round and floating in space. Okay, these are four energy channels you're cutting off here. This, 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 that's what you're doing. You're choking channels. Okay, so changing the air, breathing up. As you breathe out, make the Vajra fist plug up your energy channels. And you really are a spaceship docked here. You are like gathering the energy. Okay, inhaling, lifting the left hand. Breathe out the right. Right, inhaling. Breathe out left. So you're either thinking about bodhicitta, yogin om mani padme hum, with your aspiration to develop compassion to the extent that you'd want to bring everyone along to Buddhahood, yourself included. So radical. Are you being spacious with the breath, getting outside of concepts and just being? If at any point you feel like you're struggling, open yourself up to the support that's all around you in the room. This space is pregnant with the blessings of our chanting. Part of the Mahayana is the recognition that you can't do it alone because you don't exist in isolation. Ask for blessings from the highest aspect of your mind. From teachers that you've had. From the countless bodhisattvas who are being born again and again to help us. And to the countless Buddhas, far more numerous than the stars we saw last night. Who are radiating love and support. All we have to do is relax and open. And voila, it's right there. If your eyes are half open, you can close them now. And start to take some deep breaths. Feel this in your body. And then with your eyes closed, you can move a little bit, reach your arms up, sway, twist, but feel it. Like savor it. Oh, hey, precious body. It's a vehicle of enlightenment. Thank you. Good. So how are you doing? Please.
How do you balance the magnitude, like the excitement and the magnitude of bodhicitta with the weight, the responsibility on my shoulders? Like, tell me that it's like a lot of work.
That's such a beautiful question. Now I know you really got it. It is heavy because it's reality. Beings are suffering. I'm suffering, you're suffering. People are out there suffering tremendously. They say there's beings that you can't see that are suffering like off the charts. And that is the weightiness of it. It's very sobering. And yet, there's this like, this energy, this excitement. It's the stream of bliss. To its fullest potential, it is bliss. That's like, yeah, you know? Tantra takes the suffering and turns it into bliss. That's some good news, right? The suffering doesn't exist in and of itself. So therefore it can be transformed or transmuted. If it was a solid suffering, it could never change. And yet we experience it as suffering, we perceive it as suffering. And so the idea is not to turn away from the experience of suffering and to use it to break your heart open, to become more raw and open so that the hair touches your eyeball And in that experience of becoming more raw and open, you're like, oh my God, this hurts so much. And then it's bliss. It's just like that. And then you can't, when it goes from that, it is this unbearable feeling of suffering to bliss. How can you, you're so grateful for the suffering. It was the cause of the bliss. And it's that tension of holding both with not turning away from either one that enables it to move. If we're paying attention, if we're practicing properly, everything is moving. Everything is shifting. And it's when we lock down on things that they stop shifting that the suffering gets really strong. And that's when you know, when the suffering's really strong, you have to check, am I locked down on it? Once you start looking at it, you go into it, which is terrifying. You go into it, you find that it's very amorphous and moving. And once you're in that amorphous moving space, it's raw, there's razors on your eyeball, but then it's bliss. And they were never separate. If the suffering turns into bliss, how are they separate to begin with? They're not. Yeah, you guys are so good with the questions. So one way that my teacher, Lama Soltama Leone, said it recently that really stuck with me is that, is this the right time to say that? When our desire has an openness, this is not what she said, this is me saying something else. When our desire has an openness to it, it's not that kind of craving. That kind of craving desire, the three poisons, says if my happiness depends on getting that thing over there. When it's really just open, there's no problem, there's no tension there. Part of what Tantra is about is not, there's a little bit of a subject change, it's a slight pivot, but you'll see it's interrelated. It's not dismissing desire. But even not in the Tantric system, just in Sutrayana Mahayana, the desire to be of benefit to beings is good and beautiful. But you can also make it neurotic. You can burn yourself out. You can get weighed down in the oppression of all the suffering. And then you're off. You've lost the openness. And how do you know you've lost the openness? There's this incredible heaviness. There's no movement anymore. Part of the Bodhisattva path is the ability to bear witness to tremendous suffering without shutting down and collapsing. It doesn't mean you can fix it all. You have to actually just be there with it in the horrific heartbreak of it. But it's in that heartbreak that the possibility of ending the suffering emerges. And so one thing that I've been noticing, like more acutely recently in my own path, is there's this like tightness and craving. It is craving around enlightenment or around helping beings. Like I want it so much. And I have to open it up because it just creates this tension that is totally against the flow of where I want to be, which is spacious and open. And it's part of the process. All of these techniques, they are designed to bring your hidden neuroses up. And they're going to come up in different levels, different shades, all the time. And often we go through one and we're like, ugh, did that, check. No, dude, just buckle your seatbelt. It's going to come back in a different gradient. So you get used to it. And the idea is that it's through making contact with whatever arises that you grow and change. So it's really beautiful, rather than us being like, ugh, that one again. No, the ugh is the very thing that's gonna pop into bliss if you actually like reach your hand out towards it. Yeah. Here, maybe we should mic this so that it's on the recording. Sorry, you're the one that had to start it.
I'm just wondering about drowsiness, sleepiness. Mm. Like, I have like old. Well, I'll just leave it open ended.
No, go ahead.
Well, there's different ideas that I have for like either kind of like trying to like either shift the practice or like be with the tired or just let myself be tired or so I'm just curious your thoughts on it. I was doing just breath.
Yeah.
Like spacious breath.
So it's layered, it's nuanced. And it depends what the source of the tiredness is, which you're not going to know. You have to just explore and figure it out. Sometimes tiredness is just, well, I'll state the obvious, that you're tired. And then you just take a nap. I mean, right? And mostly we're tired. And so when I like to do retreat by myself. And then then it's no big deal if I take a nap, you know? It's more difficult when we're in a group. So that's one thing. Maybe you're just tired, in which case you take a nap. Sometimes it's just an untrained mind. Your mind is not used to being quiet and still without a lot of stimulus. The only time it's used to doing that is before it falls asleep. So out of habit, it gets drowsy. And that's something you want to train the mind out of. And for that, you would use techniques to wake yourself up. So you can stand up. The scriptures say, splash water on your face. If you're a yogi, you go upside down, you know. There's different meditation techniques. Vipassana has some really nice ones to wake up. Bodhicitta or something that's very inspiring to you can also wake the mind up. Chanting can wake the mind up. So I said one cause could be that you're just sleepy. One is a habit of the mind. It just doesn't know how to be quiet and still bright. Another can be that there's something in the unconscious that's starting to come up. Often it can be a psychological thing and you're not ready or equipped to deal with it yet. So the unconscious is like, snooze it out. So my Zen teacher was like, if you're tired, you just sleep, because we don't want to force anything. So sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's the mind about to have a dharmic breakthrough, which is different. It's closely related to the, like something coming up in the subconscious, but it kind of feels the same. And the nervous system isn't ready or the ego's not ready, and so you get tired. And that's also okay, it's part of the process. And then it's part of the process of learning to suss that out. And when do you kind of open and give the opportunity to keep going, and when do you just tap out and snooze? Right. Were you raising your hand?
I wasn't, but I did have a question.
Oh, okay.
I'm very interested in not fabricating things in my reality. So part of me doesn't want to like wrap my mind to create like a relative bodhicitta. You know, like I've heard mostly intellectually there's different kinds of bodhicitta, and I some lamas say, like, if you encounter, like, absolute bodhicitta, or the actual compassion of this reality,
mm-hmm.
drop the relative
mm-hmm.
bodhicitta. And just, like, I'm just, like, interested in really tasting that, or at least understanding it.
So, relative bodhicitta it's our aspiration to be of benefit. And then what's called absolute or ultimate bodhicitta is the direct experience of the nature of reality. It's emptiness mixed inseparably with compassion or bodhicitta that arises together. Usually it's talked about that relative bodhicitta is a cause of ultimate bodhicitta. So it's encouraged to train in relative bodhicitta, and there's many methods to train in relative bodhicitta as a means to arrive at ultimate bodhicitta. Now there are other paths. Dzogchen is one. You still the basis is relative bodhicitta. You can't fabricate or force ultimate or absolute bodhicitta. It just arises spontaneously. So I wouldn't worry about working with relative bodhicitta as like it's going to disrupt the expression of ultimate bodhicitta. I don't know. Does that help?
Yeah, my concern isn't like relative disrupting absolute. It's like more like just like fabricating this moment.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get around fabricating the moment. Everything is a fabrication. So, part of what Tantra invites us to do is, rather than trying to fight it or get around it, lean into it. And the leaning into the fabrication dissolves the fabrication. And we can, the seed of that is in everything we're doing. We're like, we're so beautiful, we're so sweet, I love it. You know, we're like, however you said it, it was so beautiful. Like, how did you say it? Like, I don't want to just, what did you say?
Which part?
Like wanting absolute bodhicitta, not wanting to fabricate.
Yeah.
Like that's beautiful, right? Like, I don't want to fabricate. I want to have direct contact with what is.
Yeah.
Right? That's beautiful. It's big and vast and beautiful. I'm not picking on you, this is what we all do. But the seed of it is, I don't want to fabricate. Do you see what I mean? There's already not this, rather than like a leaning into what is. And right now, what is the fabrication. So you lean into the fabrication, and then the fabrication dissolves because there's no barrier anymore. So they say, you know, I don't know. Yeah.
Speaking of desire, how do you think about meditating on something just to like meditate on it, especially if it is a desire? Like, say meditating on someone you love without like any, I guess, intent behind it, just like to think about it, and it's almost like daydreaming.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Buddhist, so that's not like a, like, especially in the Mahayana, but also in the foundational path, the intention's everything. If you're meditating or contemplating someone, what's the intention behind it? Is it to get in contact with reality as it actually is? Is it to open your own heart? Is it to see more clearly? Is it to get a sense of like this love I feel for this person? How could I feel it for the worst, most evil, ickiest person in the world? Like, what's the motivation behind it? And establishing the motivation is going to be key. Otherwise, it's just another mundane activity, which is, there's nothing wrong with it. But as a practitioner, that's not serving my goals. You get to decide your own goals.
Yeah, I was thinking from the perspective of neuroscience, where there's some like findings that just like anticipating something or you know, daydreaming about something like produces dopamine and makes you happy.
Totally.
So, would I be right to assume that in Buddhism this is like not ideal, that you're...
It's not. You could use that, and this is actually what bodhicitta does, and it's a large part of the bodhisattva path. You can use the energy or the dopamine. Dopamine is coarse. Energy is very subtle, way more powerful. You can use that energy by thinking of the beloved or by thinking of the Buddhas, or in Tantra, you think of your teacher. And it gives this really bright energy, and then you do something constructive with it. Right? Then it becomes meaningful and worthwhile. You can also just waste it, but if it's then it's just something else, right? It's not Dharma then.
Right. I see.
I had two questions. The first
Can you put the mic closer to you?
Oh. I have two questions. The first is, when we were meditating earlier, a lot was coming up for me, and thoughts were coming up for me. And through the meditation, I felt like I was able to release some anger and grief I had associated with a past situation and extend more compassion towards that situation. But in that, while I was meditating, I was, of course, then I had my thoughts that I was going through. So it felt beneficial as I was able to extend compassion to that past situation, but also as I wasn't being present with the meditation.
Mm.
So how, I don't know, I don't have a question in there, but.
Yeah, so when we do what I called analytical meditation, it's not my favorite term. I have to find a different translation for it. I haven't studied the etymology of the Tibetan or the Sanskrit, so I got to think about it. We're saying it's okay to think. We're thinking constructively, right? And so it's not that you're not, it's okay, it's already in bounds. Everything's okay. That was part of it.
Well, this was for the meditation prior to that, the one we did earlier, not the analytical meditation.
Oh, in the very, when we first started. Okay. Still. The experience is, whatever it is you're working with your breath, you're working with mantra, you're doing some non-dual meditation, and then the things, this is a technique, the things come up, feelings come up, memories come up, somatic experiences come up. That is what's happening. So engaging with that doesn't mean you're not present. You're present to something else. You're present to those thoughts, those memories, those somatic experiences. So depending on the scope of the meditation, it's fine to turn your awareness to that and engage with it. Provided, and only you will be able to judge this, that you're not getting like fixated on it, that you're not being carried away there. It's continuing to move and flow, right? How do you know it's moving and flowing? It's changing. Things are unraveling, right? It's okay. Unless you're doing a practice where you sit down to practice and it's a single-pointed practice and you've decided, I'm focusing on this image of a Buddha or this felt sensation of my breath or whatever it is, and you decide that if something else comes up, you're going to drop it and go back to that. Mm-hmm. But that's a different technique. That technique enables us to do the meditation you were talking about.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I had one more question. So earlier when we were talking about suffering manifesting into bliss.
Yeah.
I found that lately I used to be very weighed down by the heaviness of the world and sadness and all these really overwhelming feelings. And lately I have been able to process the suffering in the world in a way that doesn't bring me so much pain. And I've been feeling very content, but I feel a lot of guilt with that. Mm. And I feel guilt not holding that weight, not being angry, not being sad. And I feel like I don't have the right to, because then I'm ignoring the pain in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very beautiful. Very, very beautiful. Part of what happens when we get overwhelmed with the pain in the outer world is that we're simultaneously touching into pain, personal pain that is overwhelming to us. That's what causes the overwhelm. And so whether we, it doesn't entirely matter which direction you go at it from. You can really work at your experience with pain with the outer world. And if you're open, it will also be healing the inner pain because it's not separate. And vice versa, you can work with your inner pain. And if you're really open, it's going to help you attune to and respond appropriately to the outer pain. The idea is that you're never fixated on one or the other. So when you're overwhelmed with the outer world, you make a link to healing your own unprocessed emotions that you're still overwhelmed with. And when you're overwhelmed with your inner emotions, you make a link to being attuned and present and wanting to respond appropriately to the overwhelming suffering that we see in the outer world. And you just keep moving between them until they dissolve. Like that. It's really beautiful. Then, okay, so then the guilt comes up. Great, big deal. So now you're working with guilt. So what does that feel like? How do you attend compassionately to guilt? Right? Probably carried guilt, you know? Meaning like you got someone else's guilt. We take the guilt on of others. You know, psychology is really good at unraveling that one. But it doesn't matter. Whatever arises, oh, now I feel guilty. Great, you work on the guilt. Now I feel angry. Great, you work on the anger. You know, now I feel depressed. Great, now depression's my object. That's it, going into it. And none of it's a big deal, right? It feels like a big deal, but holding it really lightly. Oh, there's the guilt. It's in the same way that like, you're like, I want pizza. And then you're like, I want tacos. Like big deal. They're just like momentary thoughts that are arising. They're just in the form of feelings that feel really heavy. It's just pizza, tacos, chocolate ice cream, strawberry ice cream. You know, we don't have to make such a big deal about it.
I noticed during the second sit that my mind wanted to grasp onto either people or parts of the world or certain situations that I could like hold on to as like, this is suffering, or I want not even like a specific instance, but like I want to relieve this person of suffering. And I'm wondering how much of that, like I did feel like there was a flow to it. I wasn't like holding on to one person. But I'm curious how that fits into the practice.
I think it's very skillful, and we do use meditations like that all the time. In fact, it's really good because it takes it out of the vagueness of like, may all beings be happy and Buddhas. Like that's really vague. But you're like, no, this person who's really suffering, them. So you start there, but then you go into, I know what it feels like to suffer. I don't want them to suffer. Do I also not want myself to suffer? Like you play with it like that. I think it's beautiful. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so if anyone else has a question, we'll do one more question, then we're going to take a break, and then we're going to do some other stuff. Yeah.
I want to ask a question that's related to her question in terms of the emotions come up. Mm-hmm. That you mentioned, it's like holding it so lightly, right? It's like a pizza or taco. I feel when I can't get that feel of light, I can't do it. But there are moments it's like that feeling of I can't do it, it's so far away, and it like I was like devoured by it.
Yeah.
So how to work with that?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. So part of the training, it does not always work out this way. You can't hack it. But the idea is to catch yourself before it becomes the tsunami that you are going to be crushed by, nothing you can do about it. But you, before it's a tsunami, all this stuff is happening, building, where you can interrupt it or bring it down. And there's a myriad of techniques to do that. But your question is, what do you do when the tsunami is already there? You can't run fast enough to high ground. It's a low island. It's it, right? You just grab a palm tree of compassion and you hang on. You go back to your intention to relieve the suffering of yourself and others. And you hold that intention, that little palm tree, as best you can as the wave crashes down and it hurts and you're going to get beat up and bloodied, but you just try not to let go of it. And then, but the water will recede. Just like that. There's this misconception that when you start practicing, you're never going to get mulled over by the tsunamis. You definitely will. And they keep coming. Sorry. But you get better at interrupting them beforehand. You get better at being in them, which means the water recedes faster. And they start to lessen in intensity. Like they really, really do. And it's these experiences of being able to interrupt them, of being able to weather it with more grace and dignity, and watching them go down, that gives us confidence of like, what I'm doing is working. Let me keep going. When I work with people one-on-one, often one of the first things we do is we build, I call it an SOS kit. What are the tools that is the right fit for your mind when the tsunamis come? And they've got to be simple. They can't be complicated. It can't be too fabricated, right? So you can start to build that out for yourself. But they're very basic. They work with the body. They work and compassion. Compassion is the thing that really helps us the most. It's like, you know, when you're the most upset, the thing that helps you is just like your friend hugging you and loving you. It's that. Good, so it is, these clocks are different. We'll go by this clock. When the big hand reaches the one, we'll be back, we'll start again. Yeah? Okay, thank you. So, a couple of things. This is not specific to Tantra, although Tantra exacerbates it. But if, according to Buddha Dharma, the thing that's getting us into trouble, meaning the thing that's causing us to experience suffering in this really locked down way, in a way that's at odds with how things actually exist, is our ignorance, then when we hear teachings, and they don't have to come from Buddha Dharma, when we hear teachings that reveal that ignorance or that help to dispel the clouds, it's considered purifying. It's purifying the veils that keep us from seeing clearly. And all sorts of weird things happen when we purify. Your neuroses, your junk can come up higher, but it's considered a good sign. It's being flushed out. Similarly, like a fever is flushing out the infection. Your body can get really hot. That's very common. It is just hot in here, but also you can get hot. You can get really sensitive and kind of, and just like weepy. You can get anxious. And again, this is not specific to Tantra, but Tantra makes everything magnified. The body can like shake or jerk, things like this, and it's just the energy dislodging and moving through. And so it's very good to hold it lightly and not make a big deal about it, but also to know when to ask someone if it's becoming disruptive. Because what can happen is like if strong emotions start coming up or weird things happen in the body, you will stop meditating or stop listening to the Dharma because it's uncomfortable. So it's good to talk to someone if that stuff comes up. It's no big deal. It totally happens. It's par for the course of being especially a yogi, but definitely a Dharma practitioner in general. A lot of the tantric path, both within the practices themselves, and then there's preparatory practices, of which the Sutrayana Bodhisattva path is considered one, is about purifying. It's about clearing out and collecting merit, collecting good karma. And as we heard in this beautiful poetry, the highest karma is the wish to be of benefit to beings. So they say. I don't know. But that's what they say. So there's these practices that are traditionally done before beginning serious Vajrayana practice. It's called Nundra, which in Tibetan means preliminary. And they're preliminary purification practices that are, yeah, they're meant to purify your body and your energy and your mind. To prepare you to become a worthy vessel or container to work with the energies that you encounter in Tantra. And I think that you got a little taste of it this morning when we were chanting. And you know, you want it. I mean, I felt it, right? Like I'm like, oh, I hope the chant comes back. Like that energy builds, and you don't want to let go of it. But you don't quite know what to do with it, right? Well, that's nothing, right? It's just the tiniest taste. What do you do when the energy is really strong? You know, how do you hold it? How do you work with it? How do you spread it out so that it doesn't overwhelm you, so it doesn't become a tsunami? How do you refine it so that you can contain the power of a tsunami in a drop of water? That'd be cool, right? It can't crush you if it's a drop, right? And it's a learning process. You have to learn. It's just like anything. It's like, how do you know if you're going too fast on a bike or in the car? Because you go too fast and then you're like, I don't know if I can do it. And then sometimes you learn you can, and sometimes you learn, no, you gotta downshift, you're going too fast. You don't have the capacity there yet. And it's part of the process, no big deal. Yeah.
How do Buddhists think about rewards and punishment from karma in this life or after?
What was the first part? How do Buddhists think about...
How do you think about, like, rewards or punishment?
Rewards. Oh, there's no concept of reward or punishment. Karma is thought of as a natural law like gravity. It's completely objective. It has nothing to do. No one's congratulating you and no one's slapping you on the wrist. It's karma is whether or not you go. It's thought of the natural state of a mind is benevolent and open and loving. And when you are in alignment with benevolence and openness, there's no fixation of a self or an other. You are creating good karma. And when you're out of alignment with it, when you think you're separate from someone else, when you're prioritizing your needs over someone else, when you're prioritizing someone's needs over your own health, it's going against the grain. And the result of that is that you experience some suffering later on, because it's contrary to the nature of reality. It's very cut and dry. It's considered just a law of the universe. You can purify it. We're purifying gobs of karma right now. You can hack it, ish, by doing things that you know or you believe to be in alignment with the way things actually are, good deeds, helping people. Yeah. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
So how do we sense the law of that law? Like, I can sense gravity.
Oh my gosh, I know, right? You guys are so good. You're making my job so easy. I bow to you, seriously. That's one of the big problems with it. Well, actually, we can sense it. When something is in alignment, if, you know, goodness feels right, it just feels right. And when you're really open, when you're really kind of like in your best openness, like things that hurt yourself or others, it feels wrong. That's our own wisdom reflecting back at us. That's sensible. Now, when you're worked up, when you're in a tsunami, or even if there's a rain cloud coming, it gets very hard to sense it. Then you're like, well, I don't know. I think maybe in this case, you know, there's all these rationalizations that come along. But the verification of karma, big problem. But it says it's too complex. And they say the higher you get in your realization, the more access you have to it, but only a fully enlightened being can really see it because it's super complex. I don't know, man. And that's difficult. And it's a lot to hold, and it means we should hold it lightly because we can't verify it. But I also can't actually verify that the earth is round. Like, I really can't. And no one has given me the telescope to see an atom. And I certainly don't get to see the one that spins them and splits them. But all these things I take on good faith, right? Where it seems to check out. So karma's a working hypothesis for me. And then the more I hang out with these higher level, these teachers, these beings that have higher level realizations, they reinforce it because they're like, yeah, I definitely saw that. I mean, that's, you know, and I don't like, it's just a working hypothesis. But For me, it's a very useful working hypothesis. It helps me distance myself. It helps me like not take things so personally. And that's where I find it to be very useful. And it helps me take things not so personally with other people. I'm like, oh, it's just something that's coming up from their past karma. Just something that's coming up from my past karma. It's not like me. Yeah.
Speaking of hypotheses, what's the general science of karma? Are all human lives, including future ones, equal? Is there some math around it?
I don't think there's any math around it, but what do you mean equal?
As in you can say all human lives currently are equal, but given there's some belief in reincarnation, what about future or past lives?
Do they have equal value?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anything that has a mind, any is equally valuable, equally.
Any animals?
Yeah.
And is there a line insects versus?
They do draw a line of whether or not the being is cognizant. So His Holiness doesn't think that an anima, whatever.
An anima? Oh yeah, an amoeba.
An amoeba. Wait, say it again.
Amoeba.
Amoeba.
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he doesn't think those have minds. I mean, I don't know whether it does or not. But there is a line there. It has to have awareness, has to have some consciousness. Yeah.
Not to digress too far, but in the rocks and atoms and things that are...
The Buddhists are saying no. Yeah, I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about there is some, the trees have something, so I don't know. There's some energy, but maybe not a mind. I don't know.
Yeah. You probably still have compassion for them.
You have to. They're not separate from you, for sure. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, so this morning we talked about that underneath the earth right now, there's all these little, they were seeds. We know they're already sprouting, right? And they're gyrating under the soil, and they're going to push up, and then they're going to become flowers. And the flowers are the Buddhahood. And the seed is the potential. And within the seed is the flower. Yeah. So Tantra is recognizing that we don't experience the flowers, but the seed does exist. But we're going to start treating seeds as flowers. We're not going to delude ourselves and say a seed is a flower. If you do that, we're going to put you away. We're going to hold that a seed does validly appear as a seed. But we're also going to recognize that it is also a flower. It has the potentiality of a flower, therefore the flower is in the seed. The seed is inseparable from the flower. So we're going to start relating to seeds as flowers. Why? We're going to see if it makes the world a better place, if it makes our mind happier, if it makes other people happier, if things get more in alignment with reality. It's an experiment. And it's fun. It's cool. Yeah? Okay. So we're going to break into, we don't have much time. You're going to break into pairs. And you're going to say hello and your names. And you're going to feel so excited and want to go talk at a yak, but you can't because there's no time. And then you're just going to close your eyes facing each other and just recognize or process or consider that the person sitting in front of you has the seed of Buddhahood, has the seed of enlightenment. If we didn't have a seed of enlightenment, you could never become a Buddha. You have to have the seed, right? It's not like some god in the sky sprinkled Buddha seeds to some people but not others. Everyone's equal. Everyone's got a seed. The cockroaches, Hitler, everybody's got the seed. So you're gonna just, hey, look at the person, be normal, close your eyes, and sit with the fact that they have the seed of Buddhahood. And what would it be like, again, your eyes are gonna be closed, to relate to that person as if that seed had already blossomed in them. And then I'm gonna ding the bell, boom, and you're gonna consider that you have the seed of Buddhahood. And what would it be like to relate to yourself as if that seed had already flowered? Does it mean you're a Buddha? No. Is the person in front of you a Buddha? No. I mean, maybe, I don't know. But if they don't appear to you as a glowing orb of beautiful light, consider them not a Buddha. You don't see them as a Buddha yet. You know what I'm saying, right? Mm-hmm. Like that. That's what we're going to do. All right, is that clear? Any questions? Okay, I have a question for you. From any time after this last session until now, did anyone even have the thought that you were walking through fields of flowers? Yeah. Good. Oh, good, good, good. So part of this is also just a basic training in mindfulness and remembrance. Being aware, remembering the instruction. And then, that's the first part, right? It wasn't until after lunch I was laying down for a nap. I was like, oh yeah, I forgot. And then the second part is, can you open up enough to imagine it, right? Because we're so locked down. The world is flat, damn it, you know? Okay, so I was just curious. Okay, so when you break into pairs, please chop, chip, chop. But do it with someone you haven't spoken to yet, if you can. Yeah? Okay. Fuzzy. So I'm going to walk you through it. First, you know, be normal, say hi, say your names. And actually, like, no, go. Be together. And then just take a second and look at your new friend. Like, oh, hey. And then close your eyes and go inward. And just consider that this person, by virtue of being aware, by being cognizant, by having a mind, has the seed, the potential for full enlightenment. And isn't that extraordinary? And here we are walking around the world, not even recognizing the seed of Buddhahood all around us. And what would it be like if you related to this person as if that seed were fully blossomed? How would you feel? How do you think they would feel? If you treated them with the dignity of Buddhahood. And now consider that if they have it, you have it. That's the beauty. You didn't get left out. By nature of being, you have this. You are the seed of enlightenment. The seed is the flower. They're not separate. And what would it be like if you related to yourself? As if you had fully developed capacities for love. If your mind was as vast as the universe. If you spontaneously, naturally extended help and compassion in the exact, appropriate, perfect way. How would that change the way you view yourself, the way you feel about yourself? How would it change the way you interact with the world if you moved through it as if you were already the flower? Do you think you might have some more fun? You might dance and sing a little more? Really enjoy your food? Howl at the moon, paint the sunset. Now see if you can touch in with your own desire to be happy. To be free. To know that the world isn't flat, even though it seems so flat. And how amazing would it be if you saw someone crying in utter anguish because the world is flat, to help them know it's a circle in space and it's beautiful and brilliant and magnificent. And I'm not going to leave you as long as you think it's flat. No way. Now bring your mind to your body and to your breath. If you like, silently in your mind, you can say some Om Manis. see if you can find that place, that joy that's also sad, that sadness that's joyous. They're inseparable, so let's try not to squash either one. Now recognizing how radical and amazing this afternoon has been. I mean, I can't even remember everything we've done these past couple hours. It's like we've been on a whole journey. We've read scripture and we've meditated and you've asked really beautiful, really insightful questions. You've just touched in very deeply to your own basic goodness. First, make the wish that this good karma, which is definitely in alignment with how things are, make the wish that others might benefit from it. And then be even more radical. Give the good karma away. Like you're setting a dove free. With a recognition that by giving it to others, you too benefit because you're not separate from others. And the fact that everyone in this room just gave it away, look how much more you got back than if you just kept it for yourself. And with happiness, with gladness, with joy and bliss in your heart, take a nice deep breath in. And a long breath out. Open your eyes. Smile at that Buddha sitting across from you. Look around the room. Oh, hey, Buddha girl. I see the seed of your enlightenment sparkling in your eyes. Thank you all so much. Thank you for being here so that I can teach and talk about these things. It's not like this is what I get to talk about every day. So it's very, very meaningful to me. So thank you. It's this interdependence, right? And we will meet back here at whatever time we're meeting back here, 7 o'clock. Yeah? Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.